Today's show is brought to you by Casper. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/GOT and using the promo code GOT.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 5, Episode 2, titled The House of Black and White. I think it's pretty obvious what that title's all about. What did you think of this episode?
I was going to avoid the obvious Michael Jackson black and white video joke, and then I literally had a black man dissolve into a white man, and what are you going to do? Are you going to do?
You can't be blamed.
Yeah, I mean, they're going there. So I was kind of anxious about it, my immediate reaction after I've watched it a few more times.
Oh, you book readers.
I know.
Getting all anxious about things you don't have foreknowledge about.
The only thing I really have a problem with still is the Dany stuff. It felt still clunky and very... It felt like a fairly black and white issue that they were wanting us to treat like it had a bunch of shades of gray, when it seems like there was room to inject some real grayness to this, you know, decision and make it be, you know, work more on that level rather than just, you know, I feel like we're supposed to walk away from this episode thinking, whoa, Dany's in over her head. But, you know, it wasn't exactly a huge matter of statecraft that she messed up on. I mean,
the way I saw it is she views it a little too black and white, where maybe she needed to understand the grays of it a little bit.
Sure.
And she didn't, and it backfired on her.
But it's like gray in the like house of cards sense of the word. Like the real politic thing to do would be to back her backers.
Yeah, yeah.
And solidate that, you know, consolidate that power.
Yeah, who really cares if the 150 slavers
right.
who are happy anymore, right?
Right.
Far more slaves.
You know, the nice thing about rich people, like was pointed out to Batman in Batman Begins, is they have so many things they can lose. So many things, you know, you think you lost a lot, but you still got your money and your houses and your fancy clothes. And I can keep taking those from you one by one until you have nothing. And I can, you know, like you said, there's several hundred of them versus the many, many teeming thousands of Myrinese. But I don't know. It's a tough plot because it's so complicated and there's so many wheels within wheels going on there at the book. And it's, you know, Martin wrote about this Myrinese knot that he created for himself where, you know, his gardening storytelling led him to have Dany and Meereen and all the interesting things happening on Westeros and staying true to her character, how to bring these things together as inevitably it has to happen unless Dany's just going to fizzle out. And, you know, his answer was 2,000 page books that kind of carefully nudge things to where he needs to be. And you just can't do that in 10 hours of television. So sacrifices will have to be made. But, you know, and I say that you know, I'm not necessarily saying that Dany even goes to Westeros at the end of all this. Like, I need to say that just in case people are saying that I'm just assuming that that's a fact. But no, that's a problem. And I hope that they'd have a more elegant, streamlined solution. And I feel like this is it. It's just, you know, shifting down into low gear and driving over some broken ground. And we're finally where we need to be. So here we go.
Yeah. Yeah. I can forgive it every once in a while. It's a little jarring, but whatever. We'll get over it. And I'm sure the next episode will be great, as usual.
This is a shame. It seems like that's the one thing, Dany, they've had a lot of trouble with. Like, season two really was terrible for her. This season, it's not been terrible, but...
Last season was fantastic for her.
Last season was great. And, you know, she's had a lot of crowning moments of awesome. And this, she's got kind of like just a bunch of moments of being mired in stuff. So...
Sure. Okay. Let's talk about who made it.
And before that, can I get a mechanical dragon on top of Meereen in the credit sequence? Like,
that'd be nice. Yeah.
To the extent of their alterations are switching a sigil and some particle effects when Winterfell was burning for like three seasons. can I get like a mechanical Drogon ripping off the harpy on Meereen? That's all I want.
I don't think so, man. You don't even get the right cities anymore. Like, no, they showed Winterfell. They didn't go to Winterfell.
No,
I don't know what's happening with that.
Winterfell's got, like, I don't know what kind of deal it signed with the producers, but it's got, like, it's got to be in every fucking credit sequence.
Does it maybe represent Sansa or Jon? Like, just in spirit, not in location?
Yeah, like, even they show the Eyrie, I guess, symbolizing Littlefinger's
really
alliance there,
time.
But they're way far away from it seems like now. So, yeah, I don't know. There is some kind of formula that we haven't figured out to what makes an appearance and what doesn't.
And I don't think they showed Dorne. Any city in Dorne?
Yeah. Have they ever shown Dorne?
I'm not certain about that.
Yeah.
But this episode they definitely didn't, even though we went there.
This is the first time we've been there, so like, what the fuck? We can't get a Dorne?
Yeah.
We can't get a Sunspear popping out of the ground?
Just not ready yet.
No water guard. Maybe they're waiting for Sunspear, and this is the water. I'm kind of shaky in my Dornish geography, honestly.
Me too.
Very mountainous and desert, and that's about all I know of it.
All right, who made this episode?
Just like last week, it was directed by Michael Slovis, and it was written by the Double Ds, David Benioff and Daniel Weiss. And, I see less connectivity between these two episodes than I do between the two episodes and the rest of the show. It's like, I don't know where they have a director Bible or what, but it just looked and felt and sounded like Game of Thrones.
Okay, let's start with the recap. Arya is staring off into the sunset here, or actually she's staring at this giant statue that is at the entrance to Braavos. She ends up getting a boat tour. They drop her off at the House of Black and White, and she knocks on the door. Some old man answers, doesn't let her in, and then she just sits there for like at least a day.
Mm-hmm.
At least a full day she sits there repeating the names of the people she's going to kill.
Mm-hmm.
Until she finally tosses her coin in the sea and walks off.
Yeah. I've been thinking about the mechanics of how the iron coin works. And like okay. I when she kept it, like I thought she was going to like give it to the man and payment for service because, I kind of always imagined that these iron coins were something that these faceless men could like give to people as like, if you know who we are, this is your coin to get a service from us in the future. And that's kind of like a favor from the Godfather. It's extremely valuable.
Uh-huh.
And if you would go to the House of Black and White with these iron coins, maybe you could get them to take care of a problem for you, if you know what I mean. But now it's just like a badge.
Mm.
And is it like some combination of like, say if celebrity came and knocked on your window and said, hey, I need a ride 15 minutes downtown, and it's Tom Cruise or it's...
Well, it has to be someone a lot taller.
Scarlett Johansson or something like that.
It has
like
to be
that.
Taller than Tom Cruise. I live on the second story.
It's like you're just impressed with how famous they are and you do it combined with they might kill you if you don't. Is that...
Really? Tom Cruise is going to kill me if I don't?
I mean, the fisherman seems he loves these guys, but he's not really getting anything out of it.
Maybe he does. Maybe behind the scenes they're helping him out. I don't know. It seems that is a way to identify people who are not just sympathetic, but maybe candidates for this shadow society themselves, the faceless men. I think that's why... I don't know, because he gives the coin back to her at the end.
That's what blew my mind.
Yeah, which means that she, like, this guy gave her the coin in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So she must carry it around until she finds someone else to bring into the society, I guess.
That's mildly interesting. I mean, that's taken to the next level. Like, well, if it's not for this purpose, then what purpose is it for? And yeah. I don't know.
It must be something like that, because he got rid of his by giving it to her, and she can't get rid of it by tossing it into the sea.
Sure.
Maybe she has to give it to someone.
Although he's probably got like a fucking bucket full right in the door, you know?
The
way they shot that, where you could see the camera seemed like it was on a boat.
This is like, what is it, Bobby Fischer, that movie where he's handing out the pieces of paper.
The grandmaster
now.
Yes.
He pulls them out of his briefcase. Yeah. Here,
how many
50,
do you want?
Have 100.
The way they shot that, I wouldn't have been surprised if like a hand popped out and snatched it like Lady in the Lake style. And I also wasn't going to be surprised if like we followed it underwater, because it almost seemed like it was going to be the Jacques Cousteau underwater adventure thing, and there was going to be some weird dude down there.
Oh yeah, I like how the camera is kind of floating on the waves.
But no, I some could choose to believe that he jumped in the canal and fished it out. I just think they've got a whole
It's
like a Chuck E. Cheese coin token dispenser in there.
Sure. I think it's supposed to be mysterious. Like, these people are supposed to be... their abilities are not supposed to be necessarily clear yet.
Sure.
And I think that's part of it with this coin. Anyway, I noticed that Braavos looks an awful lot like Venice in a lot of places, like maybe a medieval Venice.
Sure.
A lot of canals going through it, and seems like boat is a good way to transport around that place.
It was honestly less seedier than I imagined. I imagined it like darker and foggier and kind of more, but it is like...
It looks more like a big marketplace.
I guess I always viewed it in the lens of the Faceless Men, and, you know, it's also got the Iron Bank of Braavos, and there's all kinds of professional guilds, and it's a bustling, you know, very rich city, so I guess it shouldn't surprise me that it was more, you know, shining city on the hill than it was, you know... 1800s London on a bog river or something. So
yeah, it's kind of the congregation of most of the wealth in Westeros here, right?
Sure.
Anyway, I think it's really funny how she kind of frumps down on these steps, just like,
right,
ugh, fine,
right.
And then she walks off. She's like, fuck this, I don't need the coin, I'm gonna do this myself. Yeah. I'm gonna go off and kill these people on my list.
I don't know if it was that, because I thought she was going to be like, fuck off too, but then it seemed like maybe she was just going to hunt some pigeons, get some drink, you know, get some water, because she was exposed.
Oh, and then come back?
Yeah, yeah, like, you know, like, you can only stay on the steps for so many days before you die of exposure, and that's not how a faceless man would do.
No, but tossing her coin in the sea was an indicator of, like, fuck this, I'm done with this.
Or maybe if I'm going to... Yeah, yeah, that's a good point.
All right, let's move on. Podrick spots Littlefinger and Sansa in a pub. And Brienne goes over and tries to get her to accept her protection. She turns her down, much like her sister did. And then Brienne fights her way out of the pub. They take off on horses. And a roughly Return of the Jedi battle sequence ensues here.
Sure.
I thought this was really cool. It needed a little bit of action this episode, and this was a good scene to do that with, especially when she has to make a choice between Podrick, like going after Pod and saving him, versus following Littlefinger and Sansa.
Sure.
Although,
I think she's going to.
She kind of does both.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you could tell, like, you know, I don't like this guy. He's just going to slow me down. He's
and
clearly
she was
useless.
Trying to tell him to go away. I don't need you anymore. Sure. Right before this, so now it's like, well, I guess I'll go save him.
There's a lot to these collection of scenes other than Brienne going outlaw, chopping a log in half with a sword, chopping a man in half, chopping a sword in half.
She chops everything, yeah.
She pulls the Duke Boys routine on Sir Roscoe and Sir Enos of House Hogg by, you know, backing in the thing, and then they come roaring by, and she's if only her horse could spin its wheels, the illusion would be complete. But there's a lot of interesting things between Littlefinger and Sansa. She's asking him about what that raven message was about, and he's like, oh, it's good news. My marriage proposal's been accepted. And she says, I thought you were mourning the death of my aunt. What do you make of that, Jim?
Well, I feel like there's a farce here that everyone understands. Like, I don't think Sansa ever believed that he was in love with the lady up at the area. I don't know her name. Catelyn's sister. So she knows what's up, but I feel like she's just kind of, you know, trying to get him to reveal stuff by pointing out those obvious things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, look, I thought you were in love with my sister. What's going on here? I don't know. I'm not sure who he's marrying. Does he say that in that scene?
He does not.
I didn't think so.
Let me, I must stress, none of this has happened in the books yet.
Okay. I was very surprised.
I can speculate. Mm-hmm. What if he's talking about her marriage proposal? Like he's made a wheel and deal for her.
Ooh, did she, so? Are you saying that she asked for this, or that she
I don't know. I don't know what reaction. I don't know who it's going to be. I've got some ideas of where they could.
So he's
start
implying
some of this stuff
that in the future she will ask for this. Is that right?
Why are you saying that he's where's
I'm going off your theory
from? Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. That this is a marriage proposal from Sansa?
No. He has made without her knowledge. He has made some kind of horse trading deal with somebody for something.
Oh, okay. To marry her off to someone else. Not
him. Yeah, yeah. Presumably that would put her beyond the reach of Cersei, which still is kind of mind blowing to me where that
could be.
Well,
I wonder
in Westeros.
Now, after seeing this episode, if that isn't Dorne. With the way that they're protecting Marcella,
So it'd be a swap. They get Marcella, Jamie gets Marcella out, they slap Sansa in. Although, I mean, the whole idea of marrying Marcella was to kind of secure peace with Dorne, something they need. I don't know that swapping Sansa for Marcella solves that problem.
Yeah, probably not.
It is an interesting theory.
I mean, north of the wall is another place, but that seems crazy.
And who, this time? And also, like, Peter wouldn't, Littlefinger wouldn't value any kind of marriage alliance with someone north of the wall, I wouldn't think.
Yeah. I mean, unless he thinks he can lead the northern armies, but
right.
The wildlings, I doubt it.
So,
I don't know. There's a lot of other good stuff, like Podrick spotting Littlefinger only because he's perving on this barmaid.
He's the power of his horn dog powers. His Westeros famous pod the rod abilities.
Good stuff. I still have a slight problem with this scene.
I also love the fact that Brienne just flopped with Sansa the same way she flopped with Arya, just on the strength of her resume. Like, it's so funny watching her tell the truth and how ridiculous that seems.
A face with a shadow. Oh, a face with a shadow.
And the way Littlefinger can play that, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, he was kind of there. Like, he was kind of sort of a firsthand witness. And Sansa and with her own
failures,
eyes,
you know.
Sansa with her own eyes saw Brienne, you know, bowing and scraping before Joffrey and his new queen, which I think Brienne did as good a defense of herself as she could. Mm-hmm. But still, Sansa is salty.
She has every right to be
about that. Yeah.
I think it's especially effective when Littlefinger says, you know, she was supposed to protect your mother. She didn't do that.
And she's got that swank ass Lannister sword. Her side, I mean, it just doesn't look good.
Steel. No,
it doesn't look good.
Definitely doesn't.
She might need to file off the ears on the, you know, do something else, make it a gold snake or something. I don't know what you do with the lion head. Turn it to a wolf.
There you
go. Try to get a Smith.
House Stark. Yep.
There you go. It's golden wolves, because the Starks are all about golden wolves.
Maybe you can gild it with something, some other kind of metal.
Sure.
Jamie's got the gilded steel hand that looks like gold.
Right.
You could gild this with steel. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have a slight problem with the arrangement here and the timing and everything.
Okay.
Brienne and Podrick are essentially on foot because they only have one horse.
Yeah.
Littlefinger and Sansa have a carriage and 10 knights all on horseback.
Yeah.
And you're telling me that these people on foot end up at the same pub as a caravan all on horseback?
Yeah, I've been trying to...
When we've seen them, they're already behind. It's not like they were ahead and the carriage caught up.
Yeah. I mean, I try to think that through the last 2 days, and what I come up with is that Pod and Brienne left the Eyrie well in advance of Sansa and Littlefinger. They met up, like, say...
But we know
like
that's not true, because they watched them go by.
Well, but that Brienne said something about I saw them on the road, and she implied it that it was like less than a day's ride, like much less, like maybe, you know, a couple hours ride before they got here. So it's like they passed and caught up and then stopped at the inn, and then Brienne and them caught up. So
I don't know how they pass with someone on foot.
Yeah, but you've got situations where people are riding from the wall to King's Landing in like a day in this show. It's
it's not the only time problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the Millennium Falcon warping from one side of the galaxy to the other. It's like,
so you're saying these are not the droids you're looking for.
Exactly.
Sort of thing.
Yeah.
Never mind the plot holes.
It's because of dragon magic. Dragon magic might happen.
Sure, yeah. I'm sure Melisandre was involved.
Sure. Not just shadow vaginas. She's a world-class travel agent.
We kind of talked in the instant cast about why Brienne reacts the way she does here and fights her way out, I think. I think that still holds.
On second viewing, it does. I completely missed the fact that that guy was moving to stop her. Like, you can't leave without our lords when she...
Yeah, and she elbows him in the face.
Yeah, yeah.
Takes him out.
It's still like... Who wins? Like, so, because that's kind of a renegade outlaw move to make, but she's also on an official mission from Jaime Lannister.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering... If she was accosted by some other minor lord that's upholding the king's justice, and Littlefinger says, hey, this woman chopped up all my dudes and tried to make off with my lady friend here, and she goes, but I'm on a mission from Jaime Lannister. It's like, does that get her out of her neck out of a noose? Does that buy her enough time?
That's the scary thing. I don't know.
When that letter comes to King's Landing and Jaime's fucking around in Dorne and Cersei opens it,
she's
how
like,
many cups of wine has she had that day? Does she remember who? I mean, like, that's...
Yeah.
that's what I was worried about, that this kind of puts her in a roguish territory in the eyes of a lot of people, which is not going to make her cause any easier.
Definitely. And I would just say I would not feel very comfortable with the knowledge that I'm on an official mission from Jamie if I were Brienne. I don't think that's enough to save you, given the way communication works in this
world. And the way Jamie works, like, he's...
Yeah.
I mean, we like him a lot more, but he's still, like, you know, his sister said, a man of action, half cocked. Does he remember he sent Brienne on this mission?
Does he remember Brienne?
Yes.
Like, no.
I had a father once. I remember him.
I don't know if Tyrion would recognize Podrick anymore. Has he lost a bunch of weight? It looks like Pod has slimmed down significantly.
I don't think so. I think he's always been kind of that level of stocky.
Really? I felt like last season he was bigger, but maybe not. Maybe it's just padded armor or something. Who knows?
Must have been all the calisthenics and Littlefinger's whorehouses.
Probably. So after receiving a snake statue with Marcella's necklace,
it's like the opposite of a lifetime membership to a buffet.
It's a lifetime gym membership?
Kind of.
Okay.
It uses all those seldom used muscle groups. Sure. Works out those hard to reach areas.
So we go back to Cersei, and she's got a snake statue on her table with Marcella's necklace on it. And Jaime sees it and decides he's going to go to Dorne to get their daughter back, but he's not going alone.
I would like to see the deleted scene of Cersei putting that box back together, because clearly she popped it, saw the threat, and then Rubik's cubed it back together for Jaime to pop again.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. Unless she didn't know what was in it, but I can't imagine that.
No, like, you know, I'm going to wait to open this before Jane. No, I just thought that was, it was made for an impressive visual, but the second I'm like, wait a second.
Yeah, I'm feeling bad for Jamie in this scene. Once again, because Cersei is laying all the blame for everything that's happened with their kids at his feet. Because
it's just what his father
Because
did.
He won't admit something that would, like he says, get them killed in the first place. It's like...
But that is kind of a dodge, because Jaime in season one was not at all interested in being a father to anybody.
That's true.
So some of this is he protests a bit too much.
Some of it, but there is some valid criticism in there,
and
too.
And he's new Jaime, too. He's, you know, put aside the whole queen raping business. He's a lot more sympathetic character. He's a lot more self-centered. Losing his arm has changed him in a lot of fundamental ways. And now I think he is thinking about these things in a different way. I mean, sitting in a cell for however long, you know, months and months could make that change. Then you lose your hand on top of it.
Sure. It seems like his mission here is to sneak in and get their daughter back and bring her back with him. Because he doesn't want an army. So obviously he wants to go in covertly.
Splinter Cell, Dorne.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. So we go to Bronn then, who is skipping stones while Lawless, I think is her name, just natters on about some dumb shit that he doesn't care about. Jaime shows up and promises him a much better girl and a much better castle if he accompanies him to Dorne.
Sure.
As south as south goes.
Bethany P. asks us for a recap of where we last left Bronn. And
it was with Tyrion in the dungeon.
But just like briefly, you know, in season two, he's the guy that sent the flaming arrow into the wildfire that exploded all Stannis' ships. He was rewarded with a knighthood for that, and he became Sir Bronn the Blackwater.
Yeah.
But he didn't have any like castles or holdings or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Then he mentioned when he visited Tyrion in the dungeons last year that his sister Cersei had paid him off or bribed him with this Stokeworth lands.
Yeah, not to fight in his tribal combat.
Knowing that Lawless was, her sister was barren, so if anything were to happen to her untoward, he would inherit all those lands. Mm-hmm. And he promised Tyrion that if anyone ever made an offer, I would give you a chance to match it. And of course, Tyrion couldn't. Mm-hmm. So that's where he has taken possession of Cersei's bribe. And then Jaime comes and undoes all that, which... Do you buy it in Bronn's character that he's just going to let Jaime ride up and say, yeah, all this shit is gone. It's gone. And you got to do a dangerous mission with me to get something maybe better.
And also, it's dubious.
I mean, like, the Lannisters always pay their debts, but he just fucked him. So
they also lie a lot. Yeah,
they do.
It seems like if I'm Bronn, what choice does he really have, though, at this point? Like, is he going to go back to King's Landing and just be Sir Bronn? what is he going to do without the castle and the woman that he wants, you know?
And he can't just, like,
this offer is better than nothing, I think.
I mean, what's interesting is, for most of the realm, Jaime is this big bluff that no one knows about. Like, he's lost his arm, but everyone's kind of unsure. Is he still the Battlesword and Westeros? Bronn knows firsthand that he could kick his ass easy.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can just murder him and get away with it.
Murder Jaime?
Yeah.
No.
I mean, if you were in the north, you might be able to do that. Or if you were in the Erie, you might be able to do that. But I believe the Stokeworths are right in the Crown Lands. It's like, you know, in the back door of King's Landing. So you couldn't just murder the king's brother and get away with it.
I wouldn't think so.
But he didn't seem, he was less displeased than I thought he would be.
Like I said, he doesn't have much choice here.
Yeah.
He can be a nobody with nothing, or he can trust Jaime just one more time and see if it pays off again.
It's a great scene, though. It's funny. I really like him essentially promising this Lawless that he's going to murder his sister and her not.
she likes it. She's happy about that. So you think in some ways.
You think she gets the threat? Because she seems a little dumb to me.
I don't know. First of all, she looks a lot like Kale the Snail from It's Always Sunny. A lot.
Won't be the first Always Sunny reference we make this podcast.
No?
Spoiler alert. Yeah.
Oh, boy. When he suggests that mean sisters get what's coming to them, she definitely smiles and she's happy about that. Does she infer what he's actually saying? I'm not sure.
I think she's taking this as the karma.
Like, you know, he's going to go pull her hair or something.
Or just that something bad will happen and she's a good person and she'll be rewarded for being virtuous.
Yeah.
That Fookin stuff. But I really like then, like, cause you know, speaking of Tom Cruise, Jaime Lannister is like the Tom Cruise of Westeros.
She's completely starstruck when she sees him.
And he's super good looking, and he's also the best swordsman, and he's a Kingsguard. And I mean, there's all the stuff. And yeah, I liked seeing, because you don't really see that aspect of the Lannister mystique. The fact
that
him and Cersei are like consensus one of the best looking people in Westeros.
Sure.
So, before we move, there was a very sly wink to book readers when Jaime mentions that Lawless and her castle is going to go to Sir Willis Bracken, that I'll talk about in the spoiler cast coming out Friday. But it took me the second time watching it and then looking up that House Bracken to get it. But it's my belief that was a little bit of a wink to us.
All right. I have no idea what that could be. Anyway, we go to Dorne.
Then I've done my job.
And Alaria is trying to talk Doran into going to war with the Lannisters, or at least letting her cut off Marcella's fingers and send them to Cersei. But he refuses. He's a little too smart for that.
Yeah, and
he understands the consequences of that.
And I get that she's angry, but even Oberyn wouldn't do that. I mean, he made it a point of saying, we're Dorne, we're better than you. Like, sinking to their level for vengeance isn't what he would advocate doing.
Yeah, and I kind of like this scene when it's compared with what Dany is doing. And, you know, the idea later on that the law is the law. This guy understands the trial by combat is something that Oberyn opted into.
Yeah.
That it's not something to really seek retribution for, to get vengeance for. It was kind of fair the way it happened.
Right.
He's not happy about it, but he knows better than to go starting wars or picking fights with Lannisters at this point.
I think it's interesting that, you know, Prince Doran seems very physically different from Oberyn.
Is he in a medieval wheelchair?
He is in a medieval wheelchair. And they also talked about Tywin came in and asked about him last season during the Purple Wedding and said, asked about him and said, how's he doing with his gout? Or that's like a rich man's disease or something. I forget exactly who brought it up. Yeah, he's got like
foot problems.
I'm not exactly sure what it is, but he's very laid up and he's very physically lame.
Yeah.
But as far as his disposition, I think it's an open question about, does he share more of his brothers?
If he only had a tricorder, man, he could just fix all of that.
Because that's the thing. Like, he, as the eldest brother, he's had to be the statesman, where his brother could be more the rogue.
Yeah.
And piss people off and all that. But, you know, and it's just like he was saying, it's you know, the people of Dorne want blood and war. Well, it's a good thing that they don't get to make the decision. It's mine. Because he seems like he has a lot of duty that he feels towards his people.
And he seems very intelligent, too, understanding the way that this world works. Except when he says, not while I rule. That is the downfall of any king anywhere, is to say something will not happen while I rule.
Yeah, that's essentially equivalent to a cop talking about being 2 weeks away from retirement.
Yes, it's, exactly.
It's not something you want to say, especially in a show like Game of Thrones. So that is
no.
That is something to be worried about. I did like Alexander. I think it's Sadiq.
I don't know exactly how to say it.
I don't want to just call him Dr. Julian Bashir, even though that's kind of the thing we do. I just want to give him the respect of trying to pronounce his name. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen him in anything since that, and I thought he really, I think he really filled the bill as far as living up to kind of the billing of Oberyn's maybe a little bit more measured brother.
I think so, yeah.
But, you know, you could tell, too, that he's a man of passion. Like, it's everything he can do not to come out of this wheelchair and declare war is how I took it.
Absolutely.
But that's probably the thing that the Lannisters would want him to do as well.
Could be. The other thing that I noticed in this scene is the mention of sand snakes. They seem to be some kind of Sons of the Harpy-esque sort of thing, but they're on the side of the government in a lot of ways. But now they're on the side of the people, it seems. Mm-hmm. In regard to this specific issue, I think they're like mercenaries or something. I think this is the first time we've heard them mentioned in the show.
I think they were mentioned last year, but I'm not sure what connection was made to them. So I'm just going to say it's all mildly interesting.
Okay.
And I'm intrigued by your theories.
At least I don't think that's the last we'll hear of them.
Okay.
I think that's a given.
That's pretty solid. Yeah. Pretty solid speculating there, Jim.
So Dario leads Grey Worm toward a suspected Son of the Harpies house while lecturing him about the tactics of finding people and how you get information and, you know, don't be so obvious about it. Be more like Dario.
Sepinwall said this is a very Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's elementary, dear Watson. Stab the thigh!
Yeah, so when they go in the house, Grey Worm doesn't find the guy hiding in the wall because he has no fear. Mm. But Dario does, and so he finds him. And they find a mask in the wall, which proves that this guy is one of the Sons of the Harpy.
Yeah, that was very Inglorious Bastards, too.
Yeah.
The whole, you know, you have to, if you don't fear, you don't think like these types of people, then you won't be able to see it. And he was right. Astonishingly so.
Yeah, I don't think that there is a ton to talk about in this scene. It's all fairly straightforward. Do you think the Grey Worm is, it looks like Grey Worm is surprised by his lack of ability to find these people. Do you think that's going to change him at all?
I don't know. Because, you know, Grey Worm, if you really think about him and all the Unsullied, they were little boys that were then trained to be soldiers. And that's the thing, like, professional soldiers are really shit at anything else. You want them to be a peacekeeping force? You want them to investigate shit? Do you want them to kill lots of people efficiently? They can do that.
Sure.
They can do that. But the other stuff, historically, they're not so good at. And I think part of that is, like, she got an army for conquest and conquering. Mm-hmm. And what she needs right now is a peacekeeping force. And what do you do? You know, that's something that great powers and countries have spent a lot of time and energy thinking about. I don't think anyone's got it quite right yet. But it would be interesting to see him have a little personal development because he is just that little boy, and he doesn't have any life skills beside that. His relationship with Miss Sandy is interesting for that reason, too. Because, like, what is his fascination with her? Knowing that he doesn't really have a penis or balls, or testicles, if I'm going to get clinical.
Stones and pillar, please.
To put in her vulva, her vagina, her vaginal barrel.
Okay. Uh-huh. yeah, so I don't know what trajectory that's going to send him off in, but it was certainly interesting. It's going to give him something to think about, I would say. But what do you think about Barristan being that guy? Could Barristan be the guy who is the peacekeeper, or is he trained more for combat as well?
Well, that's a really great parallel, too, is that I think he means well, and he's got the wisdom of seeing it done a lot of different ways, mostly terribly. But you got to think when he starts running his mouth, he sounds a lot like Ned Stark. And
that's not a bad thing, in my opinion.
It's not a bad thing, but it's also, it seems like to be a successful politician, you have to have a little bit more Frank Underwood in you than Ned Stark. And
a little more Littlefinger.
And maybe like you can try to be more altruistic than that, but you have to wheel and deal and make hard decisions and not just go down the middle every single time because that's just going to piss everyone off. And there's also, like, you know, and it's hard to talk about this in ways that doesn't, like, you know, I already had an inbox full of people, like, with problems as far as, you know, is this a racist depiction of a primitive people or is this a... and it's like, I just feel like if we, like, the city of Atlantis popped back out of the ocean and they were still keeping slaves and doing Greco-Roman trial by combat and practicing human sacrifice, and we went in there and we said, y'all got to stop this. That, you know, it's like, I feel like that there's this universal sense that, like, the humanist secularist / Judeo-Christian / whatever is, like, the only way to be. And it just, like, makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I think it is, like, you know, I fully subscribe to all those values. But if you look at the world and the things that go on it in terms of the darker side of humanity and just, like, how animals behave, where it's, you know, bloody and brutal and you take what you can get, you could come up with a equally valid worldview saying that, you know, the might does make right and oppression of the weak is what's only natural.
Yeah, the limitations are put on us by ourselves.
Yeah.
We're trying to be better than that. And you've also got to wonder, is it even other people's place to tell that society that they can't be that way?
Right. And it seems like that's something that people should do, but going about it, like, you're going to have for those first few generations that have had experience with the old way and not the new way, you're going to have a really firm hand, but also, you know, it's like this, everything this former slave said about, these masters raised me to understand them and they only understand brutality and bloodshed. He's not wrong.
Yeah.
And I even felt like it was really interesting when he said, look, Misa, I saw your hands were tied. I knew what you wanted to do, but you're doing all this law stuff, so I helped you out. Like, that is actually very progressive of an understanding from his point of view.
Okay, but it's a problem from her justice and freedom point of view.
It is. And again, like, there are no easy answers to these questions.
Certainly.
Like, unless you're, like, a literal god that's omniscient and omnipotent, where you can just force your will by fiat and strike people down for thought crime. I mean, you're just going to have a rough few generations of getting this thing the way you want it to be.
Yeah, you don't change people's minds by delivering force.
No.
You change people's minds by understanding them and working with them, and that's a much more difficult thing to do.
But you do wonder if she would be better off of just killing all of the slavers, literally. So you have, you know, any one people are going to have different thoughts and feelings, and they're going to be at different spectrums of what they want out of life and how kind of justice and mercy they want. But when you're dealing with that in two different, very different classes of people, it is an open question about whether she shouldn't have just put them all to the sword.
Sure.
And started over with her people.
Yeah, that's a fair question. I think
that's horrific.
If there's one thing that all of the slaves can rally around, the former slaves can rally around, is the vengeance upon their former masters.
Sure.
Even then, you might run into some small problems with people thinking, wow, that's a fucked up way to handle this.
Sure.
But I think that problem is going to be less of a problem than what she's currently in.
And she's kind of, when she says stuff like, the law is the law, well, the law was we were slaves, and you said ignore that and kill all these guys.
Here's the thing.
So what does that mean,
even? The person making the laws saying the law is the law is bullshit.
Yeah.
Who makes the laws? Who makes those laws that you are so worried about upholding? Well, it's you. You are the law, and I just told you that, and you refuse to believe it. I don't know how I feel about Dany's reasoning abilities here. She makes a huge mistake at the end.
Mm-hmm.
By beheading this guy, I think.
But this goes back to season two, Varys's kind of hypothesis is, like, you know, his parable about the sword, the cell sword, the politician, and the priest, who has the power. And that's what Dany is struggling with. She thought she had power. And I think it did play out interesting if you could think of her as, like, this child empress, that she was genuinely shocked. Like, she expected people to not be happy or maybe to be shocked, but the instant turn from Misa to, it really shook her to her core. And I thought that, you know, that's what's the great thing about the show is it asked a lot of these questions, and there are not like clearly right or clearly wrong answers for those things. It's just what's going to be what if you're trying to mitigate misery, what do you do?
Well, one step that she took that I like is that she put after she had Hisdar come into her council somehow, she also put a former slave in the council.
Right.
And I think that was a smart thing to do.
Sure.
To at least balance those two opinions
and
views of
her
society.
Small council is pretty good, and she seems pretty wise about putting similar small councils around, you know, the rest of Slaver's Bay. So she's got the right ideas. It's just, is she going to be able to get in front of some of these crises fast enough?
I don't know. We'll find out. So we've kind of talked about this scene where all of the advisors are arguing about what to do here. I don't know. There's this Barristan sticks around and convinces her, I guess, that she should be merciful here until, you know, the other former slave goes and does what he does, kills that guy.
Yeah, he told her about the Mad King, which is, you know, kind of her father. And I thought that was a commentary on their relationship, that he felt comfortable enough to speak this frankly about her family.
Okay.
You know, to say that, like, your
father was a Mad King.
Your father was, like, use that words over and over again. He was crazy. He did evil things. And it's just, you know, he could tell that he was desperate to try to reach her, because he does not want to come over all this way with his last hope of finding honor and then have it turn to ash in his mouth.
Certainly. So then we go to Tyrion and Varys, who are traveling to Volantis, we find out, while Varys delivers a sort of pep talk to Tyrion. I don't know. Sure. Tyrion's literally trying to drink himself to death on the road to Meereen. And Tyrion is feeling shitty about himself. And Varys is trying to say, hey, you were good at something. You were really good at that governing thing, but it just didn't work out because, you know, other things transpired. There are a lot of good lines in here. I love when Tyrion's like, oh, she should offer her cunt, the best part of her for the best part of me.
For my head, yeah. Although, having said that, I got to say, out of all the road shows we've seen, you know, we had Bronn and Tyrion, then we've had Arya and the Hound, then we've had Jaime and Bronn. Well, not really Jaime and Bronn, but Jaime and Brienne. Yeah. We're about to get Jaime and Bronn, which has a lot of promise. Mm-hmm. Varys Tyrion's not as entertaining as I would thought. Like, there's something a little... I'm not...
They're more commiserating. They're, like, commiserating over being outsiders, you know?
They're just bitchier.
They are, certainly. I don't know. I didn't have a problem with it.
Maybe the other thing is that I really like Tyrion, and see him just kind of wallow the way he is painful.
Could be.
But yeah, that could be a possibility as well.
So Varys says that the road to Meereen is at Volantis.
Uh-huh.
I seriously doubt that is literal. I think he's going to meet up with someone who can help them get to Meereen. I think he's got something else up his sleeve that is not necessarily like, oh, well, here's the start of the road that takes us to Meereen.
Literally, like, exit here for Meereen.
Yeah, I don't think so.
No.
I think he's meeting with someone, as he tends to do.
Definite mild interest there. Sure.
He's got his feelers out.
All right.
He's calling in favors.
Okay.
Anyway, Cersei's delivered the head of the wrong dwarf, and Qyburn takes it for some foul purpose in his dungeon.
Did you see the body this time around? Because I know you didn't on the instant cast.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's under the sheet, sure.
There's a big body under a big white sheet.
He's taking his sweet ass time resurrecting this guy if he's gonna do that. I'm saying. Like, he's probably just there rotting.
Frankenstein was working with buried body parts, all I'm saying.
It's true.
You know, like, true. I don't know if there's an expiration date on that shit.
Maybe not.
I mean, look at those ice zombies up north of the wall. I mean, they're just
They're preserved.
Not even refrigerated. Skin and bones.
Yeah. So then Cersei goes into the Hand of the King's chambers, their meeting chambers. I don't know exactly what room this is, but she's promoting people to different positions of importance until Kevin puts the kibosh on it and heads off to Casterly Rock to wait for the real authority to contact him, the king. Everybody here is very suspicious of Cersei, and I think rightfully so. It seems like Star Wars guy, I can't think of his name, Marjorie's father, is a little overjoyed by his position. He's kind of won over by, Yeah, well, oh, I would Mace gladly be the, yeah, my, the Master Mace Tyrell, of Coin.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, I think, like, that's the thing. Like, nobody is suspicious of Cersei. They're all consumed with their own place in the world.
Like, until she mentions Kyber and, like, being...
Well, that's what I'm saying.
The
that,
Master of Whispers or whatever it is.
That's the Grandmaster Pycelle. That's him more being pissed off that this up jump start is on the council, and that diminishes his power than he is at really, like, this guy is just a terrible choice for the small council. Well, I mean, there is that, but I think it's mostly his personal power. The only one that seemed like he just wants to serve the realm is Kevin Lannister, which is why he's like, peace out. I will wait the king's leisure at Castle Rock.
Yeah, have the king call me if he needs anything.
Yeah.
Man, I love to see Cersei just getting shit on. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. And when a guy with as much gravitas and probably authority as Kevin has, being the king, the former Hand of the King's brother, I just really enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's an open question.
Because there's nothing, like, she can really do, because she is there without his consent.
Right, right.
You can tell.
I mean, like, that's one open question, is how good is Kevin Lannister? Like, would this single-handedly save the realm if he would be the Hand of the King or take a personal interest in here? You know, because he's always been the younger brother of Lord Tywin, who's pretty much ran the continent for a good chunk of history. So, you know, it's like you get reports of him being steady and reliable, but he's never been the one to call the shots. But I feel like in this scene, they're really showing that he's got a lot of the same metal that Tywin had. Maybe
he does.
Maybe even superior, because since he hasn't been in this position of authority and having to try to, like, be consumed with his with his family's glory and power, maybe he could be like all the positive things with Tywin. He's kind of like a Tyrion, all the positive things with Tywin, with more compassion and mercy and
altruism.
Yeah.
It seems like it, certainly. Yeah. The other thing that this scene does is it tells us firmly where Varys stands at this point with King's Landing. Varys is on the lam just as much as Tyrion is.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure about that after last season, after the finale. I didn't know if, you know, he just took some kind of leave and went and secretly helped Tyrion, or if he actually ran away like Tyrion did.
Sure.
Now it's clear he did run away. She's appointing people to his old position.
I felt like it was fairly well suggested that was the case, but you're right. This is the first confirmation that, like, nope, he's gone. He's been replaced.
Yeah.
He's a wanted man.
Totally. We go over to the wall where Shireen is teaching Gilly to read. And Gilly is kind of feeling bad because she can't read nearly as well as Sam. And he's kind of putting a lot of pressure on her to hurry it up, getting impatient.
Mm-hmm.
Gilly then tells a story about her sisters having grayscale, as you know, Shireen calls it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have a name for it north of the wall, apparently. But Selyse comes in and tells Shireen to stay away from that horrible, horrible wildling.
Mm-hmm.
I have a big question here.
Okay.
Why is Jon referred to as Ostrich Stark?
It's not Jon. It's not Ostrich Stark. It's some other guy. But he was the youngest Lord Commander at 10 years old. Which
it's not John. I thought it was heavily implied in this episode or in this scene that it's John.
No, I think this was a little bit of foreshadowing that, like, you've got this youngest Lord Commander, and in the books, John's like 16. In the show, it seems like he's 20, in his early 20s. Mm-hmm. But still, like, you know, some people might be watching a show and thinking, there's no fucking way that this boy is going to be promoted to the Night's Watch. And then it's like, oh, well, you think that's mind blowing? A 10-year-old got to lead the wall at some point, which.
Yeah.
That's always crazy to me. Like, I'm reading...
What life experience could a 10-year-old possibly have to educate him enough to be a leader of men?
I don't know, man, but I read, like, Patrick O'Brien, some Age of Sail fiction, and this stuff has historical precedent, where you have boys of 4 and 5 manning guns on fighting ships and then becoming corporals and lieutenants at, like, 11 and 12 and leading men in boarding charges and shit. So it's like, you know... I think kids are a lot more capable. Like, we maybe have gone overboard the other way. Like, it's like, well, that's horrific. You can't send a 5-year-old to work in a factory and get chewed up by gears. Can't send them off to war. I feel like in this society, we might have gone, like, overboard. That, like, you read stuff like that and you think kids are really a lot more capable than you think of. And now you get kids, you know, parents arrested because their children, they let their children walk a half a mile to a park.
Yeah, and or take, like, the subway in New York when they're 12 years old. Like, come on.
Yeah, like, I think we've gone way too far the other way, and, you know, that's the way society works, as a pendulum swing, and eventually, hopefully, we'll get to, you know, half happy medium before an asteroid comes and takes us out. But...
Yeah, I don't know.
But yeah, no, I think that was just to set up the fact that John has a chance to win this election, because they are compressing the shit out of all these plots, man. And anytime they can put a little crumb to the audience, it's like, it's okay. It's okay. This can really happen. Trust us. I'm on board with that.
Yeah. All right. This scene is pretty straightforward. You know, it's Gilly learning to read.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Why spend all this time talking about grayscale?
I don't know, man. It doesn't seem to matter at all.
I mean, we've known about Shireen having this for like 3 seasons now.
Yeah.
So there's a good bit of time describing, not just, because I guess this grayscale is kind of like cowpox and smallpox. There's like a less virulent form that if you get as a kid, you know, it might fuck you up and disfigure you, but you can't get it later on in life. Hmm. Or like if you get it as an adult, it kills you, you know.
They mentioned that she was cured somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, there could be some magic involved there. I don't know.
Right.
But yeah, I'm not sure exactly how it works.
Although their Maester Cresson was pretty staunchly anti-magic. He's the guy that got one of the ones that early... Oh, he's the one that drank the cup of poison that he meant for Melisandre.
Ah, yeah.
So, it's interesting, and I just wonder if you had any ideas about why they would spend so much time on this piece of plot.
If I had to guess, they are trying to endear the daughter, Shireen, to the wildlings. And to the people at the Night's Watch for some future purpose.
Okay.
And I have no idea what that is, not being a book reader.
Sure.
But that seems like what they're doing with this story. Like, we have something in common.
All right.
Mildly interesting.
Mildly interesting. Let's move on.
All right. Stannis is not having much luck finding people who will follow him.
He accuses Jon Snow of the high treason of showing mercy. God damn it, that's not a Stannis platform he's running on.
Not at all. But he decides to offer to release Jon from his vows and give him the Stark family name if he leads the Northern armies for him, essentially. And then in the scene right after that, we see Jon telling Sam he's not going to take that offer.
Yeah. First of all, there was a really cool thing that's straight from the book about this little girl who's now running the Bear Island, which is the home of Jorah Mormont and also the old bear that used to run the Night's Watch. Hmm. So she's basically sending him a raven message of a middle finger saying we only know one king and his name's Stark. I thought that was really cool, as was John's reaction to it. Mm-hmm. But what did you think of John turning down this offer? I thought the offer was awesome.
The offer's amazing.
And you can
what he's always wanted.
You can see on Kit Harington's face that I thought he played it really well. It's like this. It's like he's almost spinning a little bit. He's so happy.
He's too honorable. He is too honorable a man. So I feel like part of this is to honor his father. You know, his father was a very honorable man who did not break his word. If he were to accept his father's name, he would have to do it by shaming himself. And that is not something that he's prepared to do. It's kind of a catch-22 for him, almost.
Yeah. No, John's really frustrating from a plotline perspective, because it's like, hell yes, become John Stark. March south. Kick Bolton ass.
That's exactly what I want to see.
Yeah, bring the North to Stannis and crush these fucking Lannisters. Like, you can do it. You can do it right now.
Yep.
It's kind of like that scene in the Austin Powers where his son's like, I've got a gun right here. Just shoot him in the face. Fuck your honor. It's also one of those Lord of the Ring things where I feel like, you know, and this is still hasn't come to fruition in Martin's good time, but this is kind of like the Frodo and Gollum relationship. Like, maybe he should have been killed very long ago, but this person, everyone has their own part to play. And if you get out of your lane, it's a weird thing to espouse in some kind of heroic fantasy fiction that you shouldn't do the thing that looks like it's smart because it's weirdly against your, I don't know, I guess it is against his personal code and all that, but the whole, like, stay in your lane, don't stretch your boundaries or, you know, trust your gut on anything is a weird thing to espouse.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. It can be frustrating. Certainly that's what we want to happen, is Johnny go kick some ass. I just don't know how I feel about his character if he does that, or how he'd feel about himself. Next scene, which we kind of talked about the beginning of it, with John telling Sam that he's not going to take that offer, is the voting scene for the new Lord Commander of the Night's Watch. And, there are some heartfelt speeches about who should be the new Lord Commander, and Sam nominates John, much to his chagrin.
And the other two guys had impressive resumes.
They did, yeah.
100 battles, 10 winters.
Yeah, one guy's super old and has been around forever and is probably good. Alistair Thorne.
For his 6 months at last.
A giant asshole, but he's a beast and a badass. And John is...
And pretty eyes.
Surprisingly popular amongst this group.
Sure.
After Sam lays out the case. Sam does not lay out the entire case. If he were going to lay it all out there, he should probably have mentioned that John is turning down this great opportunity to... honor the Night's Watch, honor his vows.
Sam's speech was essentially, look, this guy has been a point of view character and the hero of this entire fucking series, and he's been involved in every notable set piece that happens at or about the wall, so duh. I mean, that's like, we've gotten to see True. All this guy's stuff. Like, it's a little... The way they've compressed this is it did seem, a little... a little Bad News Bears, or like the underdog winning and probably, and we like him. So it's like, but from, I felt like they could have done a little bit better job selling us on why the Black Brothers would feel the same way.
Yeah.
Ammon, like, I totally believe him casting deciding vote, because he's always really liked John, and so did the old bear and all this other stuff. Yes. And that counts for a lot, but to compress it all into like 30 seconds of debate and essentially the Comedy Central roast of Janos Slint perpetrated by Sam,
of his own making,
which was quite good. And that was a little out of character from Sam, him to be that eloquent and funny and biting to a guy that might, like, if he loses his vote, that's going to be bad for him, but I'll allow it because it was awesome.
And I have seen Sam's confidence building a bit.
That's true.
As of late. It's not like he's the same old Sam.
Sam the Slayer.
Yeah, I get the feeling that he doesn't much appreciate that moniker, but it's funny nonetheless.
They should have voted for him. How many other Black Brothers can say they've killed a White Walker and a Thin?
It's true.
Come on.
But the case he lays out is pretty good. I mean, when Alistair was incapacitated during the battle, John took over. And, the fact that he saw them through that battle... and that he then went to go finish the job before Stannis rolled up. I think these guys have a lot of respect for that.
And I also like that the way they played at the end, Sir Alistair standing up and kind of besmirching John's character with, like, you want a man who fights wildlings or fucks them?
Yeah.
And John just sat there and kind of took it. There was a little bit of kind of nobility and, like, yeah, he could have stood up and be like, there's more to it than that, but I don't think he needed to.
No. I think Sam surprisingly didn't do that.
It was surprising to me that he didn't say something
when he was the guy to bring John into it anyway.
But it felt appropriate and effective, because if you put yourself in this universe, the Black Brothers have been debating this stuff endlessly. Like, what do you think about the Jon Snow guy? He fucked the wildling.
Sure.
Well, Master Aemon thought it was okay, and Sir Alistair's kind of a cunt. We don't like him anyway. So,
yeah. All right. So John is eventually voted new Lord Commander of the Night's Watch.
And Sir Alistair Thorne is, as the Myrinese would say, his reaction is when John looks over at him.
Now, I think John is too good of a guy to get all vindictive and start to hassle Alistair the way that Alistair hassled him. I think Alistair's going to have a fine time with John as Lord Commander, whereas vice versa, it wouldn't have been.
Sure. Yeah, because Sir Alistair is, the way he views his duty, or his brothers, quote-unquote brothers up there, is fundamentally different from the way John viewed it. And you don't know. Yes. I mean, I like to think that he was a lot like John 30 years ago. Like, he's been up there for most of his life, so he probably joined as an idealistic teenager.
He's just a bitter old man now.
Probably the second or third son of some northern lord, and going to Wind Glory, and he gets up there and it's a bunch of rapists and horse murderers and horse rapists and
horse murderers.
Yeah.
Wow.
Unspeakable atrocities committed against horses in Westeros. That's the real hidden problem. Mm-hmm. So you can see, like, would Jon Snow be as upbeat and fresh faced 30 years from now if it was just the same grind of riding against the wildlings and guys getting drunk and a new recruit lot that you got to train and there are a whole bunch of lackwit criminals?
Yeah,
like that would wear on you.
You're probably right. Probably right. Arya chops the head off a pigeon and is stopped in an alley by some scoundrels,
we'll
call them that, who want it. And she prepares to fight them, but they are scared off by the man from the House of Black and White. And then Arya follows him back there, and he reveals himself to be Jaqen H'ghar.
Dun, dun, dun.
Although, as we find out here, Jaqen H'ghar is not a name of a person. That is not his name. That is something else. I'm not exactly sure what he means by that.
I'm not even sure if you even can say that.
I mean, unless, he's just like, my name used to be Jaqen H'ghar, now I'm a faceless man. Maybe he's saying that you need to abandon names because they have no value in this organization.
Yeah, and certainly, the whole idea of we got to break you down to build you up in our image and all that stuff goes with that. But, that's the cool thing about the Faceless Men is you just don't know enough about them at this stage to know exactly what their game is. And, was his name once upon a time Jaqen H'ghar? Would he really use that as a cover name? Who cares? Because you'll probably never find out. Because now he's nobody.
Sure. Yeah, and she's about to become nobody because he invites her inside the House of Black and White.
What goes on in there? I'm genuinely curious to see what you think goes on in there.
What do I think? As of right now, what goes on in the House of Black and White? I mean, it's got to be some kind of training ground for the Faceless Man. It's like a Jedi temple or something.
Okay.
Beyond that, I'm not certain. But she's clearly going inside to learn the skills that she needs to be a faceless man.
Yeah. No, there's so many great questions entering in this part. Like, what are the faceless men? What are their skills? Are they magical? Or is this more like Mission Impossible style?
But they don't give us any answers, so I don't feel very comfortable talking about those questions.
No.
Because we have nothing to say about them.
No. But this whole, like, Arya, Arya's voyage is the thing that I found most entertaining on the initial read through.
Yeah. It holds true in the show too.
Really excited to see what exactly she ends up finding behind these two doors and whether it follows the book or whether it's a remix or what.
Yeah. All right. We move on to Dany.
I actually felt like that was a good climax. Like when she walked in, I thought I was going to see the fade to black. And then we went to Meereen. I'm like, oh shit.
Yep. One more big scene with Dany. She's got, the former slave on her advisor staff, ends up killing the son of the harpy that they caught. And she decides to have him publicly executed for it. Then the former slaves Meereen don't much like that. And they begin to riot. And then later that night, Drogon shows up at Dany's pyramid and flies off again. We've talked quite a bit about the politics of this scene and the mistakes that she's making here. I don't know how much more you want to say about this.
Just my frustration that this was such a black and white issue, because it's not like imagine if they busted in this house and it wasn't this guy, it was his father who was plausibly ignorant of his son's designs. Like, they find the stuff there, but it's in a hidden patch. They didn't find the son. His father doesn't want to give up his son, even under Dario's questioning. What does Dany do about that? That is a much more interesting question than you found this guy hiding in a terrorist cell with his weapons, with his enemy uniform. He gives up the fact he's the son of the harpy, which is the biggest puzzle is why the hell, what was she waiting? What kind of trial could she give him?
Well, I don't know that they wanted to muddy the waters with that question. Like, they wanted it to be very clear that she had found someone that she was looking for and that this slave was justified in killing him, really. Because if they had muddied that
but
question,
even then,
was this
just
slave
kill
doing the
him.
Right thing?
He killed them in a highly public way with a not sanctioned message of kill the masters in blood. Like, there's nothing else that Dany could have done here, and I found that frustrating because it literally took her decision. Like, there was a lot of interesting decisions. There's lots of interesting puzzles, but, you know, you could debate, like, how could she have done this better? What if she just had a private trial and had him executed and, you know, have the Lorax talk to his rich people, rich dude buddies that, you know, and have him get the message out that, hey, Dany means business. Would that, you know, sway things? And you can kind of blunt the message to the former slaves. I don't know. We had someone on the forums was talking about, like, what if Dany suggested trial by combat with Ser Barristan as her champion? That would be cool, and I feel like something that, like, the people clearly don't get this whole the law is the law, but they would be all about trial by combat.
Sure, it gives them a little bit of the fighting pits back.
And it would also kind of grease the wheels towards, you know, furthering that plot.
Yeah.
Just having this black and white situation where it's obvious this guy was guilty, it's obvious this guy acted on his own and did something grossly improper and abused his power. Like, it was a little too simplistic.
So I'm not clear on the laws over in Marine.
Well,
she says the law is the law.
Dany is the law.
Yes, I. Well, no, the law is the law.
She's very Judge Dredd that way, Judge Dany.
But what I'm getting at here is, are they the same as in King's Landing? Could this slave request a, or this former slave request a trial by combat?
That's a good question.
Is that something that's even allowed over there?
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like...
What gods do they worship? Like, I don't even know what the religion or law is like
to me,
over
that's
there.
More of a medieval thing than a religion thing.
Okay.
Like, the whole trial, like, whatever gods you believe in...
But it's based on the
outcomes,
gods, right?
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Whatever gods you believe in, you
so
believe
all
that they
just
would...
do the trial by combat thing. Like, that's just a god thing. It's not a particular god thing. It's just a higher power thing.
This is me making shit up, honestly, because I don't know. I don't know.
Sure.
But I'm saying, like, if you were going to introduce a foreign concept of justice, that's something it seems like they understand. You put two combatants in a situation. Hell, it even looks unfair because, you know, Barrison's old as hell and he's gray and withered and they don't know that he could cut them all down like so much butter even now.
Yeah.
Like, that seems like something that even Dany could abuse.
Maybe
like,
so.
Just send him to Ser Barristan, have him sort him out.
Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't totally clear on what exactly the law is here, but ultimately, I don't think it matters. It is very black and white, like you said.
It's a great scene. The whole public execution and the
moment before it, where you can tell she's questioning her action here.
She doesn't want to do it.
She doesn't,
but she has to because again, she literally had to do this thing. She could either, you know, let him off, which is, you know, obviously then that I guess maybe it's not as black and white as I thought, because she could just ignore what Barristan has to say. And then maybe you start thinking, well, maybe she's going down to Mad King territory.
Yep.
But if Dany's going to be Dany of like the virtue, you know, kind of inexperienced, but virtuous, she kind of had to do these things. And that's less interesting than something more ambiguous.
I think she's unintentionally going down the Mad King path here.
How?
Because if you listen to what Barristan said, the Mad King thought that he was doing the correct thing to lead his people the entire time until the very end.
Sure.
He always felt justified. He always felt right until the very end.
But he was doing the things that he wanted to do selfishly, which I think...
He was.
And this, like, Dany wanted to let this guy go.
But he wasn't showing mercy. He was ruling with this iron fist, and everybody's calling out for mercy. Dany refuses that, and in my opinion, does what the Mad King would have done, which is, you know, this justice and freedom connection, just executing on that. I don't know. I felt like it was less her doing, like, yeah, she's doing the thing she thinks she needs to do, but she's not being very merciful at all.
Sure.
She's being a little too rigid.
Yeah.
Like Barristan says.
Yeah. I mean, that seems to be a perfectly valid point of view as well. So, but I don't know. This is still the clunky part of the episode.
It was
well executed because I did really like her shock at how quickly the people turned on him. I liked Unsullied kind of like hustling her out. And then on subsequent watches, I'm like, because it was when I was first watching, kind of like all, you know, this was all washing over me, I started thinking, like, were the slaves, the former slaves, trying to get at the masters to kill them, and Dana's getting just caught up in a crossfire? But on subsequent viewings, it's very clear that, no, they were taking shots. They were pelting her with lethal-sized stones. And if it wasn't for her escort of armed guards, she might not have made it out. Like, it was very...
I felt like the first shot was just bad. Like, the one where he throws the rock, somebody throws a rock and hits one of the former
that
masters.
That might have been unintentional. That might have been aimed at Danny.
I think it was, yeah.
Oh.
And then when she's running off, yeah, you're right. It's clear that they're angry at her.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that there is a lot of symmetries between, like, Joffrey, you know, his trying to march through the crowds and the crowds turning on him. Mm-hmm. There's also this, and I don't know if this is a feedback or this is something I gleaned on Reddit, but... if it's a feedback, then I'll give you credit when we get to there. But there's also really interesting symmetry between Joffrey beheading Ned and Dany, like, is like the mirror image of that. Like, this was something that was like an act, it was supposed to be an act of mercy that he subverted because he's a prick, and it had disastrous results that played out as we see them. She went there to condemn a man wanting to give him mercy that had disastrous, and, like, you know, which it. Where is her path going to end up different than Joffrey's?
I hope so.
Sure.
I definitely hope so.
Yeah.
I don't hate her nearly as much. That's for sure.
Yeah.
And that's it, other than, you know, Drogon showing up.
Sure.
And just flying off and her looking sad again because she doesn't have the love of the former slaves anymore, it seems. She doesn't have the love of her dragons anymore. She's kind of
lost. But does
lost.
She? Because Drogon...
Yeah, it's tough to tell with the dragon, right?
He's like definitely...
He's not emoting very well.
I thought he was. I mean, he looked like he was smiling. Like, the two that got pinned up in the pits, I was kind of debating whether they wanted to kill her or whether they're mad. I think they were frustrated. But Drogon clearly had some affection. And then he was, okay, you got close enough. Peace out, Mom. You know, he's a teenage dragon. And he looks fantastic. Like,
yeah.
It's been a good few years for dragons. We've had... a lot of dragons in Harry Potter. We've had the Hobbit stuff. But this, like, there's something about how bristly they are.
I like it.
And how it's all animated so well. It's such an alien-looking thing.
But it almost feels kind of like a bird, too, right?
It does.
Which is cool, like a reptilian type of bird.
It feels like a, you know, some sort of raptor from Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
And physically, I feel like it's a real, like, it looks really real, the way it moves and flies. And
it does.
I can't say enough good things about it, but... yeah, you wonder, there's still some connection here. You wonder why did he come back this night of all things?
Good,
like,
question.
Is the rioting in the city attracted him? Is it like death and decay? Is there some kind of psychic distress signal he picked up from Danny, implying the connection there? I thought it was a great, in retrospect, a great way to end the episode. If you're not going to end it with Arya going into the double doors, then this is a great place to end it.
Yeah, I don't know that they gave us enough info to really make a call as to why Drogon's there, but he is. And that's it. That's the end of the episode.
Hey, I want to talk about the sponsor for the podcast today, Casper Mattresses. You can find them at casper.com/GOT. And you can use a promo code GOT to get $50 off your mattress. I was a little leery when we got approached for this ad because, you know, I don't want to recommend something that I haven't tried and, you know, some blind referral. Like, if I say that this is something solid, then I want it to be solid. And Casper said, okay, we'll send you a demo mattress. All right. So the way Casper is approaching the market is they see that there's a lot of money to be saved by cutting out the middleman. To that end, they do not have showroom floors. There's not like a Casper store that you can go to try this thing out. But what they will do is they'll ship this thing out to you. And like, I got a king size bed, and they ship it in a box that's approximately the size of Lord Tyrion.
Okay.
And it's wrapped in this Tyvek package to protect it in the shipping process. They give you this nice little unique tool that allows you to open up the package without damaging the mattress. Like I said, it's compact. It weighed about 70 pounds for a king size. It's a lot easier to wrestle through a door than a conventional king size mattress, let me tell you that. Oh, that is a Sisyphean task, getting it up a few flights of stairs. And you get it there, you slice it open, it expands to its full size very quickly. I was pleasantly surprised. You know, in previous mattresses, of this type, the foam type mattress, you've had a lot of outgassing, a lot of like, you know, that chemically smell. That mm-hmm. we opened it up on a Friday night and left for the weekend, came back Sunday night. By the time we returned, there was zero odor at all. It's this hybrid blend technology of memory foam and latex foam that gives it, you know, because I've tried memory foam mattresses before and they've always been a little too firm for me. But this, I just felt like the sink is just right. And it's also cool. Another criticism of foam mattresses is they retain body heat.
Yeah.
But the latex seemed to solve a lot of that problem. Also, as far as manufacturing goes, this mattress is made in America. It's attractive. It's got a nice cover. It's one of the best nights of sleep I've ever had, honestly. I'm comparing it to about a 7-8-year-old Beautyrest that was replacing, and it was just a noticeable immediate upgrade. The best part is you can go to casper.com/GOT, enter your GOT to get a $50 off card or offer, and you can try it for 100 days risk-free. If you don't like it, you call up their support line. You tell them, take this mattress away. They will send someone to pick it up and have it recycled or donated, depending on the region of the country. How you can't get that from another mattress place.
No, that's super important considering they don't have locations to test them out.
And that's super smart. I was very impressed by the whole packaging and the whole experience and the product itself. I'm a big believer. I was in the market for a new mattress anyway. I'm actually going to get one for my son. He's graduating from a little boy bed to a big boy bed. Mm-hmm. Going to pull the trigger on a Casper because it's just really high quality. They're priced anywhere from $500 for a twin up to $950 for a king size mattress. That blows away the price points about any other mattress, especially for the quality. So I would definitely encourage Bald Move listeners, if you're in the market for a mattress, definitely consider this. And you can go look for Casper reviews online. A lot of unboxing videos if you want to get an idea of the size we're talking about. But it's a great night's sleep. And I think we got another promo coming, so I'll be able to update after a few more weeks of use of it. But I'm very impressed with it.
So all right. How do they get that?
Go to casper.com/GOT and enter the promo code GOT to get $50 off the already incredible price. Let's get the feedback.
Okay.
Let us get the feedback. B Fitz wrote in, says, I'm sure you have an opinion on organized religion based on your backgrounds. So I'd love to hear you discuss the rising militant Spiros in Westeros and what is to become of it regarding Cersei, for instance.
The rising military what?
The rising militant Spiros.
Oh, the Spiros. Okay.
As we know, the War of the Five Kings caused great devastation to the common people. When the majority of a population is starving and hopeless, they often turn to radical religion in order to get through their struggles. Today sucks, but afterlife will bring paradise. It's made worse by witnessing the nobles enjoy their 20-course dinners and decadent splendor. Do you think comparisons of the Spiros and Westeros, and the slaves in Volantis for that matter, can be made to the oil-rich families of the Middle East today and the angry, radical Islamic sects in their midst? You know, I never really thought of that as a comparison until Fitz here sent it into us. And I'm hesitant to talk about it because I feel like I'm fairly well informed as far as Middle East politics, but I feel like me commentating would be very ignorant.
Certainly, I feel that way. That was my first thought, is I don't know enough about the Middle East politics and foreign relations, period, to speak intelligently on that, so I'd rather not muddy those waters. But if that's what you're reading into it, you know, that's what movies and TV are for.
Sure.
For you to frame your experiences and learn lessons from that. And I don't know. That's a fine thing to do.
No, it's interesting because, you know, there seems to be kind of like a rise of what I would consider radical religion in the United States right now.
Okay.
And it doesn't seem to be because things are going particularly badly. I mean, like, the economy is not as great, and we've had a couple wars and stuff, but it's not like an existential crisis that would provoke kind of the militant religion, some of the religious movements we've seen.
Yeah, we don't have the fucking Zapatistas here.
Yeah.
Anything like that, you know?
So it's like, that kind of puts an interesting wrinkle, and maybe that's like a more of a cultural thing that things, like, if you look at it from the that cultural aspect, that things are going very badly for them as far as the way, you know, just the morals of the country are going, and they're reacting from that, not from an existential crisis, but this, like, this is our way of life and we don't like it, so we're kind of circling the wagons.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really apply to Westeros, because that would be, you know, more of a, like, a World War One model where, like, the whole country's plunged in war and everyone dies and it's terrible. But it seems like, from my recollections, that Europe kind of moved away from religion because of those experiences.
Yeah, they certainly
rather
have,
than towards,
yeah, at this point.
So I mean, it feels like making any kind of historical parallels is really difficult, because I don't think that that's what Martin's trying to do.
Okay.
So anyway, moving on to Alex in San Diego said, Danny made a huge mistake in beheading that guy publicly. It's just like that fight against terrorism. Boy, everybody else wants to make this comparison.
They do. They really like it.
For every terrorist you kill, you create a dozen more. You can try to kill every person against your rule, but you cannot kill an idea. I think the Sons of the Harpy will continue to cause trouble for Danny, and Tyrion will arrive just in time to broker a peace deal.
Man, I hope so.
That would be nice, because she could use, again, we like Ser Barristan, mm-hmm. but he is not a statesman.
No.
He is a warrior.
He doesn't know how to lead a nation.
It's going to be, so there might be some interesting friction between Selmy and Tyrion.
Could be.
Because he thinks he knows what's right for, and this guy's a Lannister, and
that's
the
real
Lannister
key.
Boy dismissed him from service for, you know, for no fault of his own. So he might,
yeah.
There might be some personal clashes left between them.
There's going to be a lot of distrust there. I mean, really, really, Tyrion's going to come over here now,
and you know he's going to come like some drunken asshole,
of course,
just bitter as hell, and like even if he's smart, he's going to be saying a lot of things like, yeah, you shouldn't have killed this guy publicly, that was a stupid move, Danny.
Yeah,
which she sees as being just and right. So
I feel like she's changing her tune, though, right? Like, the things that she thinks she knows are all being brought into question.
Yeah, but is she changing? I don't know that.
I don't know that she's changing, but she's at least starting to acknowledge that maybe I don't have a great grasp on this.
Alex continues, onto the wall, I think Sir Alistair is feeling some type of way, in quotes, about not being named Lord Commander. By his merit and his bravery, he deserved it, but so did Jon Snow. I think he made the right decision to elect Jon Snow.
Yeah.
Janna sides with Alistair, and I don't think he respects Jon. He's a coward, though, and I hope Jon ships him off to another castle on the wall. His knowledge is valuable, but in battle, you may as well not even have him. He can still be used on the wall, and I hope they find some way to redeem the character. What do you think about this thing?
I don't care about Janos. Like,
really?
Yeah, ship him away. He's a coward. He may talk a good game, but he doesn't show it when it comes down to right down to it. So yeah, he's useless to the Night's Watch, I think.
All right.
I don't know, man. He lines himself behind Alistair and thinks, like, yeah, I'm going to get ahead by supporting the guy who's obviously going to win.
That's
this.
What worked in King's Landing.
It does. I'm not saying it doesn't work, but it's not a noble or heroic thing to do.
No, there's no there to get here.
That's also true.
You know, it's like you're not going to line your pockets with gold or get lands or holdings and Night's Watches. Right there in the charter. It's right there in the charter. I mean, maybe you can get
the best
some
you can hope for is a good assignment, right?
You could get a bearskin rug and your quarters carved from a block of ice and the prettiest whore in Molestown.
And not emptying the latrines. Like,
yeah.
That's about it.
Yeah. This is not where you go to be a selfish, power consolidating asshole.
Yeah.
Moving on to Hef. He said, I'd like to play the name game for us. And he's got some solid ones that then devolve a bit.
As they do.
The House of Black and White, as a bald move tradition. One, Arya arrives at the literal House of Black and White, Bravo's premier bed and breakfast.
Yep.
Pretty obvious. Two, Dany in her white dress, which reminded me of a swan, confronting the black dragon Drogon. That's a fantastic dress, too. That's like one of the best looking dresses I've seen on Game of Thrones. It was simple, and it was like the white, and it kind of looked like dragon scales. Three, Barrison's reminder to Danny that justice is not always black and white. Although in this fucking episode, it was. The Black Brothers choosing Jon Snow, white, as Lord Commander. Okay. All right, still pretty solid. Mm-hmm. Let's take another step further. Sir Jaime, commander of the Kingsguard White Cloaks, teaming up with Bronn of the Blackwater.
Is there like an official White Cloaks name?
Yeah, that's what they call it.
They are?
You got the Gold Cloaks, which are the police.
All right, I'll allow it.
You'll allow it. All right. Mm-hmm. Little step further out on the plank. Sansa's complexion in contrast with her new hair and wardrobe.
And
that's where I cut off. There was like three others that got increasingly silly. But thank you for that. There was at least five solid allowed by Jim. David J said, with all these witnesses in earshot, why did Peter Baelish openly acknowledge that he was transporting Sansa Stark?
Sure.
Littlefinger wouldn't have been able to convince Brienne otherwise, but now all of his guards and other people at the tavern know Sansa's real identity, a suspected king poisoner sought by the crown. Does anything about what he did make sense, or was it just to move the plot along quicker?
Well, you're assuming that Littlefinger doesn't have everyone in that tavern killed. Like, I'm not.
He just orders a tactical nuke strike and ends wiped off the planet.
No, he has his, you know, how many knights chased after them?
Three? A lot. Like, there,
he's,
I think,
got like 10.
There's at least 10, according to Podrick, whose strong suit's not counting, sure. But.
So, you know, five of them just rampage through that place and then, and then they ride off.
I mean, that's the thing. They make it very clear that an armed knight can just plow through any good number of peasants.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if all you have is a dagger, or you've got a shitty steel, you got a shitty sword, you're a dead man against these guys. Mm-hmm. So
I could totally see Littlefinger just having everyone there killed and moving on.
It does seem, even as a book reader, and again, this plot is completely beyond, you know, they're in the Here Be Dragons part of the map of this plot. Mm-hmm. It really struck me as funny how open he was about, oh yeah, this is Sansa Stark. He completely dropped that ruse of her being his, you know, bastard daughter. So,
yeah, I mean, he can't really make that claim with Brienne, right?
No, that's what I'm saying. But the fact that
he say it out loud, yeah.
He had given it up to the Lords of the Vale, and it just doesn't seem to be that big of a secret to him. So,
yeah.
Would say that it's probably just to move the plot along quicker, and hopefully it'll make sense in context when you look back. Mm-hmm. Peter S. said, do you think the Titan of Braavos is anatomically correct? Does everyone who sails into Braavos have a look at his junk?
He's not wearing anything under there. He's just freeballing it.
Well, my headcanon says there's a whole troop of Braavosi mummers that have like some elaborate like Chinese acrobat deal where it's like a 30-man dong that like they're all linked and chained together, and they do like, you know, prehensile stunts and trapeze, and they swing from one testicle, you can't not say testicle to another. It's like a little show. It's a little show that lets you know what Braavos is all about.
Show to let you know who cleans that thing. That's what I want to know.
It's part of, you know,
an undertaking.
That's part of the prehensile nature of the 30-man Braavosi dong.
I'm not talking necessarily about cleaning the dong. I'm talking about
the underskirt area is well cleaned. It's like they're just like a human Swiffer. They just swirl all around there all the time.
Okay.
Michael P said this, and this is the Always Sunny reference, which I don't get because I've only seen about half the series. He goes, Mac, Charlie, Dennis, and Frank have finally settled their argument. Jack and Hagar definitely does the best example of blackface.
Okay, sure. Watch the Lethal Weapon episodes.
Oh shit, that's the one, because I have actually seen that one. I still didn't get the reference.
Yeah.
That was actually the second.
You watched the second one, didn't you?
Here's what happened. Yes.
Because there's a Lethal Weapon 5 and then there's a Lethal Weapon 6. Because
you fucking made me watch the show, and I saw the first one was the Dayman Nightman episode.
Excellent.
And then
episode.
The second one was the second Lethal Weapon 6 or whatever.
Okay.
So there's a rough introduction to the mythos.
One, yeah, if you watch the first one, it'll explain all that.
Okay. Can't wait.
And why they switch characters between shots sometimes.
They needed Jack and Hagar, apparently. Alexander C. said, the delightful and surprising return of Bronn has me wondering where some other characters are. Where's Jorah Mormont? Will we ever hear from Beric Dondarrion and his merry band of neutral men? Will Edmure Tully ever finish having sex with his new bride to discover the carnage in the ballroom? Also, we never hear anything about the Boltons in Winterfell and their struggles to rule a north that hates them.
Hmm.
You wondering about that as well, Jim?
I'm only wondering about Jorah. Those other ones, meh, whatever.
I'm kind of curious to see what the whole point with the Beric Dondarrion arc was.
I don't even remember that arc.
That's the guy who was brought back to life several times, tried to kill the Hound in single combat, and he was unable to.
Okay. Yeah.
I know. It's all religion and magic. It's not exactly your in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, but the Jorah stuff, like I've been saying for a while, he's got to come back in some capacity.
Kind of surprised in two episodes in, we haven't touched on the Boltons.
Yeah.
Because they're the major power.
Judging by the previews for next week, we are.
Oh, wow. Ooh, some spoiler material. The excuse Varys gave for his dislike of Stannis was Stannis' embrace of Melisandre and her magic. Mm. Varys claims to hate magic because of the necromancer who chopped off his twig and berries, his sex romancer. Okay. But perhaps the critiques of Stannis was just an excuse to cover his Targaryen loyalties. How else do you explain that from the very beginning he was scheming with Illyrio to bring Daenerys back onto the throne, despite the fact that her claim is premised on her magical survival of a night in the fire with her dragon eggs?
Maybe he's like me, and he's like, thumbs up dragons, thumbs down magic.
I was going to say, I think both can be true. He has a baseline hatred of magic, and he's also a Targaryen loyalist.
Okay.
Because I think that would put you off, someone coming and cutting your penis and testicles off and throwing them in a fire. That'd put you off magic.
Yeah, I think so.
So.
Or really anything that is the cause for that.
Put you off women?
It puts you off a lot of things.
It puts you off a deep masculine voice and body hair. A lot of things.
Uh-huh.
The whole Mance Rayder story strikes me as uncomfortably white Western hero orientalism. The free folk never embraced any ruler. Then suddenly some white guy, a Night's Watch veteran no less, shows up and they embrace him as king. What did you think of that angle?
What's that? The Jon Snow?
No, the Mance Rayder. There's a lot of, I'm not insensitive to this.
Like you're saying suddenly, but I don't think it is suddenly.
Yeah.
John makes the point that he has been his entire life working toward this goal.
Or we're talking about Mance Rayder, not Jon Snow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Mance Rayder has been building this coalition his
whole
life. Yeah,
he didn't show up and it's like, oh my God, look at this guy. And they all followed him. Presumably there was a lot of trials and tribulation, and he, through sheer force of will and hard work, united these clans against the reality that winter is coming, and so are the White Walkers, it appears. So,
I mean, I think if you're going to talk about, you know, white savior stuff, you can talk about it in context of Dany.
Sure.
And much we more did. Much and more easily, yeah.
We did the end of season three, the whole, you know, and I feel like they've taken that to heart, because if you've noticed, it's a very, very mixed collection of people in both the upper class and lower class of Marine.
Yeah, seems like
there's just all shades of the rainbow there. So it feels like they have tried to blunt that criticism somewhat. Let's move on to the fourth point. Given the technological limits of the time, how did they build that huge statue in Braavos?
Money. Money can move mountains, man.
Yeah, I mean, like, there is the real-life Colossus of Rhodes, which is not like it was commonly predicted or, you know, depicted of like, you know, I mean, the mythical depiction of the Colossus of Rhodes was a lot like this statue of Braavos.
Yeah.
So I feel like that in a world where they built a wall about, you know, 7,000 years ago or whatever, and they built all these other, like, you know, Winterfell with its glass gardens and its geothermal heating and, like, all these other things. Like, in the books, they hand-wave this as to, like, there's this Age of Heroes, and they were, like, you know, super badasses, and they had some Children of the Forest magic, and there you go. So apply dragon / tree magic to every problem you come up with, and and look at Westeros squinting through, like, you know, rose-colored tinted lenses at our own past, like, you know, the Greek and Roman history.
Sure.
And there's where you end up. Janine S. Has some thoughts. First, on the wall. This plot felt too rushed for me. I liked the stuff with the Shireen and Gilly and her mommy Dearest, but the whole Jon Stannis Lord Commander plot felt rushed. There wasn't enough drama in Jon's nomination for Lord Commander. I'd have dragged it out another episode and maybe make us really hate Thorne and Slint. Set up some conflict among the brothers of the Night's Watch as to who they choose. Heck, introduce us to Sir Dennis Malister. Make it seem who's the commander of the other tower. Make it seem like Sam really pulled off something by nominating Jon. Mm-hmm. I agree with that part. I don't think we needed to hate Thorne and Slint anymore.
No, I totally hate Alistair.
And Slint is the guy who betrayed Jon's father. So I hate these guys plenty, but I'm with you. I could have seen some scenes of some internal debate amongst the Black Brothers. One problem with that is they killed off a lot of the Black Brothers we had kind of like a personal interest in last year.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else does she say? On to the Marine topic. The pacing of this was somewhat off to her, she says. I liked the concept, but again, it felt like it was too rushed. The only part I liked was Drogon coming back, but not letting her touch him. I wonder if he... She also wonders if he can hear his brothers down in the cave.
Hmm.
Do you think that...
So him landing there was like, hey, you need to get my bros out of this cave.
Yeah, like what... You know, they call... She calls him... them her children, but what is their relationship amongst each other and to her, and how much are we just anthropomizing this guy?
Fair question. It doesn't seem like their relationship is very good at the moment.
Mm.
I bet those dragons would like to be out and about, and they're probably a little bit bitter. I don't know, assuming dragons even give a shit about that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Like, ultimately, if you live hundreds and hundreds of years, what the fuck is a couple days in a cave to you, right?
No, it's like what they it's like what veterinarians say about crating your dog. Like, it always seems to me like if you leave for the day and you put your dog in a crate, it seems cruel because they're just sitting in a box Tyrion style for like all day and potentially into the evening. But every vet I ever say is like, no, that's actually better. They feel more secure and safe. And the reason they act out and tear up shit in your home when you leave them is because they're stressed out and anxious. So what the fuck do we know? We, you know, dragons are not humans and neither are dogs.
Sure.
Much as that is controversial to say. she goes, I guess the whole segment shows that one man's terrorist is indeed another man's freedom fighter, but where does it end? Regardless of where the ruler, whoever he or she is, loses no matter what is done. An interesting paradox to explore, but again, a little patchy to me. Not sure how to fix it. Again, maybe slowing it down just a tad in the beginning, introducing some more exposition. I don't know if that would fix it.
No, I was perfectly clear on the decision she needed to make and what the options were and why she made the decision she did. It's just, it felt a little rushed with the reaction of the people and those sorts of things.
And that was the problem for me too.
But, like, but I've
already said
enough
about it. So yeah, we can just move on.
Yeah.
Devin H said, first off, I know we've seen Braavos and Meereen before, but I love how much more grander in scale they feel this season. I'm glad to know they're spending even more time, effort, and money showing us more and more of the world when, let's face it, they really don't have to. They could have kept the same sets, locations, and CGI set pieces at the same scale as last season, and everyone would have been fine with it, and it would have been great. But I love how enormous they've made it, especially Braavos. That place feels absolutely huge, not just from the CGI establishing shot, but even just exploring around the city. There's one shot in particular where Arya is waiting outside the House of Black and White, where you can see far off into the distance across the water, and there's a village out in the forest beyond. Little things like that add so much depth to the world, and CGI is amazing as always. That's the thing I was talking about, looking at like seasons one and two and how kind of small the sets felt in comparison. And at the time, it still felt like bigger than we'd ever seen before.
Yeah.
But they just keep gilding the lily. Hard to argue with that. Regarding Dany, I know people are anxious to see her fly off the Westeros, but I'm with Jim on this one. I actually prefer to see her in Essos and the drama in the story she's been given. I also like seeing the moral dilemmas and stressful situations she has to handle. Also, her going to Westeros at this point just doesn't make sense. I feel like Dany wouldn't even be content with just abandoning the people of Slaver's Bay to go take the throne, and she cares way too much about these people, much more than she cares about the Iron Throne. If she were to go to Westeros, I don't think she would do it without designating someone she trusts to rule her absence, and I think she would want to include her people from Essos in her rule from the Iron Throne, a Targaryen Empire of sorts that spans both continents, provided the dragons don't ruin everything, of course. Do you think we're going for a grand unified Targaryen Empire?
That'd be interesting. You know what might be cool is Daenerys over in Westeros at King's Landing on the throne, and Tyrion ruling things over on
the Lord of the West, the Lord of the East. Sea. Yeah.
Yeah. That could be cool.
See a dragon blowing fire up to the Titan's skirts.
Why not?
Completely incinerating those poor 30 mummers, man. Yeah. All they were trying to do.
Yeah, they were trying to just clean it.
Is give people a thrill.
And give them a show. Yep.
I'll admit I did. Oh, wait, Matt E says, I'll admit I didn't go back and review the season four episode to make sure this hasn't been answered. But aren't the other two dragons chained underground, basically trapped there?
Yes.
If they're getting to be as big as Drogon, how the hell would they ever get out of that little man sized door?
So they're not. One, they're not as big as Drogon. Drogon was clearly much bigger than them previously.
And he always has been. They've made it a point of he's been the, you know.
But you're right. They are still
the big black dragon.
Yeah, definitely. But they're definitely still in that cave. So,
but I also think that this isn't like a cave. This is in the books, they make it clear, and I think they might have mentioned this in the show, that they're actually chained in the catacombs below one of the big fighting pits of Marine.
Huh.
So if you think of in terms like if you've ever been to the Colosseum or you've seen pictures of it, like me, I've never fucking been to the Colosseum.
Sure.
Those things are extensive.
I've played in it in video games.
There you go. So you're more than qualified to talk about this.
Yeah.
You know, these things were designed back in the day to hold like to let elephants and rhinos and giraffes in and out. So I feel like that there's probably other entrances where, you know, maybe they moved big game, like, you know, whatever the Westerosi equivalent of a rhino or an elephant is, through, or like bulk, like big crates and stuff. So I wouldn't have a problem with them being able to get out, or even like these are big, strong creatures. They get the size of Drogon. I see them just like monster trucking out one of these walls because they're underground, but it's not like they're in a cave hundreds of meters of solid rock. Like,
yeah.
Someone constructed this and then put a support system over it. So I feel like a dragon, it's within their power to just bust through that if they needed to.
Probably.
All right. Dan from Manchester says, every time we see a scene between Tyrion and Varys, I immediately begin imagining a pilot for a half-hour sitcom about an old gay married couple who have become bitter about their relationship over the years. If the jobs dry up after the Thrones series is over, perhaps Dinklage and Hill would be interested. I'm sure you could both come up with a good title for the show. Something better than Bald and Chain, anyway.
I don't know. That's pretty good.
Oh, man. I forgot. I actually did brainstorm about this a little bit, and I've forgotten them all. But I didn't come up with anything better than Bald and Chain.
No, I like that one.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. With Arya joining the League of Shadows and Mosador, which I think is the name of the slave that got killed in this episode, or the former slave, sacrificing himself to save the city from a group of masked vigilantes, Game of Thrones has suddenly gone very Nolan's Batman. It seems to have worked out rather well for the masked rebels. Was it all set up from the very start when there was one of their own was found? Is it possible that Dario Naharis, being the one who found the man and executed Mosador, is working with the group and knew that these events would turn the city against Daenerys? Is this a big conspiracy, Jim?
Man, I can't imagine that. It seems like Dario is firmly on the side of Daenerys.
He seems like he's in love with her.
Yes.
That they've set up since season three.
I can't imagine a scenario in which he is involved in any kind of conspiracy to bring her down. Certainly at this point.
Which, knowing Gurm, means it's inevitable.
Probably so.
He successfully lulled you to
sleep. I just want to know what color he's going to use to describe that scene.
What?
The one where Dario eventually turns on Daenerys. It's going to have to be like the green wedding. I don't even know.
Oh, we're running out of out of crayons for weddings here. Yeah.
We are. Chartreuse.
A periwinkle.
Uh-huh.
He's a periwinkle, sure. Josh K said, I listened to the instant cast and Aaron seemed to touch on what I was feeling. I liked the episode, I guess, but whereas I used to love the ambiguity and mystery, I felt like things are becoming very on the nose. Instead of good guys doing bad and bad guys doing good, the show felt a little flatter and more paint by the numbers. It is a little less deep, a lot less deep than the books. And it's never been a problem before, but it was a little bit of a problem, especially the Dany thing. But we've already talked about that.
Yeah.
Any additional thoughts?
Nope.
Also, if Daenerys believes so much in the law, why doesn't she just appoint judges or a justice counselor or something? Instead, she makes herself both judge, jury, and executioner. I know that trial by a jury is probably too much of a modern concept for the show, but a circle of elders or something fantasy-ish seems reasonable and more in line with her professed beliefs. Is that telling us something, that maybe she should have some kind of parliamentary system set up, but she is still wanting to be the queen?
It's interesting. Yeah, she is acting far more like a queen.
And we do know the queens rule.
Yeah, she's just inexperienced.
Yeah, she's a little girl.
She has people around her advising her, but I'm not sure why she wants to make all the decisions herself. It seems like it would be a good thing. Maybe she's just afraid that no one else will be able to, I don't know, see these slaves, these former slaves, in the capacity that she does and have the same compassion and caring about them. Like, if she were to appoint a council, maybe they would just, you know, turn into people who cared more for their own power and themselves.
Which is a fairly patronizing view of things, but it's also not completely out of character.
Yeah, I mean, she had to come in and bust things like that up. So yeah. I don't, maybe that's it, but you're right. It's a little naive of her to think that she is good enough at this to just be the queen and be altruistic and awesome.
She might also not be able to handle the idea if someone makes a decision that goes badly and people die. Like, at least she made that decision. If someone else did, then she would feel bad for shirking responsibility.
Maybe so.
Moving on to Sandra P. I wanted to give my opinion on Danny's beheading scene. I don't think the scene was written poorly. I think we just need to get inside the slave's head to understand that scene. If I were a freed slave, I would see Danny as some goddess who had come to save us. I would think that she was on our side. If I'd been a slave all my life, I would think that justice was siding with the slaves to rectify our lifetime of oppression. Mm-hmm. Watching Danny behead our slave spokesman would be probably shocking, and I would get into the mob mentality hissing game too, and I would probably feel betrayed.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it just, I don't know exactly how they would feel, because another valid way to look at that was like, thanks for helping us out in this circumstance, but we've got it from here. Like, we needed to be freed from our situation, but we don't necessarily need to be ruled by a foreign power. And it feels like that's kind of where things are going. Like, you're not you helped us out, but you know,
yeah, you freed us, now let us be free.
Yeah,
that, like, sort of thing.
And the whole, like, you can see this whole Misa brother, you know, this calling them her children and they are her mother, that is already, you know, it's not patriarchal, it's matriarchal, but it's not a balance of power. It's not really a free type of relationship, and maybe they're realizing that. We have another Jim on this podcast. It's Jim H. He says, while it seemed pretty obvious that the man behind the mask was going to be Jack and Hagar, for the briefest of seconds, I hoped beyond hope we are going to see the return of Cyrio Forel. That is, if you don't recall, Arya's water dancer trainer. What do you think are the chances that my favorite character will have an equally surprising return? No spoilers, please. If there is any book knowledge on the subject, I've only read the first two so far. I'll say that his ultimate fate is equally ambiguous in the first book, if not more so compared to the show. Oh, if I had book knowledge on this subject.
Well, I don't, so let me talk about it for a second.
Sure.
His death is... So if you believe that he died in that scene, he certainly died off-screen.
Sure.
And we know that off-screen deaths are not always deaths. And oftentimes they're designed for us to be surprised when the character comes back.
And shit, in this show, sometimes on-screen deaths are not really deaths. In the case of Beric Dondarrion.
That's true. I would definitely like to see him come back. Maybe once Arya has gone a little further down this road of becoming a faceless man, and maybe that creates a conflict between those two.
Sure.
Like, he discovers what she has become, he doesn't like it, something like that, and now she has to, you know, Luke Skywalker up and fight Darth Vader here.
Sure.
I think that might be cool.
Yeah. I mean... One of the
I know you can't say much about it, probably.
I mean, one of the hobbies of the book readers in between books, which has been a while, is debate, like, hidden personas of different people. And the show kind of invites you to do that with the faceless men and people being resurrected and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, a lot of debate rages on the identities of a lot of people. And what you need to do, Jim, is read those last three books and then start Googling.
Okay, I'll get on it.
Jim H.
Oh, okay. Man, I really hate that I can't do any freaking research on this show.
You really can't.
I can't Google a goddamn thing, otherwise I'm going to be spoiled.
You're right. That's wise of you.
All the shit that comes out of my mouth is literally just coming out of my head.
That's cool. I think that's what we're looking for. We like to laugh up our sleeves as book readers. There's a lot of laughter on the other stick. On the other hand, coming from the other
Lord Commander.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of uncertainty and fear and doubt in our eyes this season.
Yeah.
Invrim, final one, says, am I the only one who got goosebumps when Stannis said he would legitimize Jon? When the camera closed in on him, his face lit up and the heroic theme started to play in the background. It made my body hair rise up. Just to see him feel accepted and wanted for the first time in his life. From that split second, he had a sense of belonging. I must confess, John is my favorite character in the show, ever since the scene in season one where he told Sam the reason he chose to stay a virgin was because he didn't wish the fate of being a bastard on anyone. His plot line has not been the strongest, but ever since the end of last season and up to the first couple of episodes, it has picked up speed and made up a lot of ground. He's the closest thing to a hero in the show, and I'm curious to see what lies ahead for him. I shipped John and Danny together from very early in the series, and seeing how some of these storylines are now finally converging, I'm hoping for these two to get together.
Wait. Where is Danny and John converging?
I
can't imagine that happening.
Well, if you subscribe to the theory that she's going to return to Westeros someday,
yeah,
and you
subscribe
to the fact that
John
is also going to be an important character.
Okay, if they end up lip-locking in the throne room, I guess.
And do not forget, this is the saga of a song of ice and fire. There's a lot of people. Ice, Jon Snow, fire, Danis Targaryen. It's not crazy.
No, I get it. It's just... to say that the show is starting to converge those storylines is crazy to me.
I don't
think that the show has hinted at that at all.
So do you think that it's possible that Jon Snow's rise of Lord Commander, dealing with the problems of the Night's Watch and Stannis and the Wildlings, are not unlike what Dany is going through in Meereen?
I mean, they're not totally unlike that.
I think that's what he's saying, the convergence, is you're starting to see
there are
some
parallels in their storylines?
Yes. Okay. They would have a lot to talk together if they ever met.
That's fair. I don't know that they've made any movement toward bringing those characters together physically.
But he's a shipper. He's reading the tea leaves.
You're right. You gotta throw some... A lot of stuff goes out the window when you become a shipper.
Have you seen inverse fan fiction? It's pretty disturbing. Ooh, yeah. That's the thing. Like, you Google it up and you see what he's got. Unspeakable things with dragons.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jon Snow in those stories has a dragon tail. He can shoot fire, and you don't want to know what he uses it for.
Sure. You don't deserve that, Inver. I'm sorry. Thanks for writing
I'm just
in.
Not seeing it.
That's fair, because I do think that you have to kind of squint, but this is something I just actually put together. We're talking about it. There is a lot of parallels between what Jon's doing up at the Wall and what Danny's trying to do in Meereen.
You're right.
And I think that if one were to come to the other shores and they got hurt, they got wind of that, that would be kind of interesting. And again, that's shit's never happened in the book so far. So hell, one or both of them can be dead. In fact,
I would believe any of that.
Yes. Yes. Anyway, if you'd like to send email, you can do so to this show at gameofthrones@baldmove.com. You can also join in and participate on our threads on Facebook, at forums.baldmove.com. The cool thing about our forums is we have separate threads for show watchers and for book readers, spoiler guys. So you can check that out. We won't have the spoiler section today. That's going to come out each Friday around noon to give me a little extra time to consider the feedback and come up the tinfoil section. So if you missed that last week, check your feed. It's definitely there, released on last Friday. So. Mm-hmm. You can also follow our release schedule on Facebook.com/BaldMove and over on Twitter @BaldMove.
You know, one other big thing they can do for us, iTunes review. We haven't asked for those in a long time, but that seriously does help a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it would. Because, every time you have a new season, you're kind of blowing the dust off the thread. A couple of recent iTunes reviews, if you don't support us in any other way, that would be super helpful.
Definitely.
Just claw our way to the top of the pyramid that is iTunes.
That's it. Thanks, everybody. We'll be back next week. If you're not a spoiler guy, we'll be back next week right after the episode. If you are, like Aaron said, check it out Friday. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.